Think Again with Borderlands Cooperative.
Join us for critical conversations about things that matter.
Every Friday at 10 a.m. on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on your dial.
And 3CR Digital, streaming live at 3cr.org.au.
So together, let's think again about important matters affecting us, like economics,
politics,
education,
health,
climate,
and what we can do about it all.
Welcome to our 335th program of Think Again. Think Again is a program of Borderlands Cooperative, which has been working for social change for over 28 years. My name's Marie Brennan. I'm on the board of Borderlands Cooperative in Footscray, and I'm here with Emeritus Professor Rob Hattam from Adelaide University, the new merged Adelaide University, and he's joining us by phone from Adelaide today. And after last week's teachers' strike, we thought it'd be timely to think about what's getting in the way for teachers and young people doing some good education. So, welcome, Rob.
Yeah, hello, Murray.
Hello.
Thanks for inviting me.
That's very nice to have you here. Why don't you say a little bit about what you've been doing for a while?
Yeah, okay. Sort of a quick version of my CV then. I taught chemistry in public high schools in South Australia for about 14 years and then moved across to the university sector, firstly working with Professor John Smyers, who was, his project at the time was really trying to advance the critical sociology of teachers' work. We did studies on teachers, we did studies on early school leaving, and then eventually I moved to the University of South Australia about 30 years ago and subsequently did Australian Research Council funded studies on pedagogy in the middle years in the northern suburbs, researching reconciliation, researching local governance of Indigenous communities along the Coorong, refugee schooling, educational leadership. Through all of that, of course, you got sort of interested in trying to analyse, the policy logics that people in schools are working with, and maybe that's the topic for today's conversation.
That is, and I hope it's the first of several conversations we'll have about that. Now, in your work, I heard you talk last December at the Australian Association for Research in Education, and I thought you'd built a pretty compelling argument against the policy regime that we've got now, that's been in place for a few decades, really. And a key plank in your argument is that we've all, in education, been infected by a germ, a global education reform movement, GERM. Can you tell us a bit about what you see as the logics of this germ?
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, first of all, I think Pasi Salzberg's research on the germ is sort of interesting. He proposes, and he comes out of a sort of a Scandinavian context, that there's sort of two models for the germ, you know, this global education reform movement, which probably is really sort of driven by the OECD and these other sort of international think tanks. And, you know, their work's, 40 or 50 years old. And sort of you can see how the sort of development of an education reform movement sort of maps onto the shift of political philosophy from a social democratic philosophy that Australia had in the 60s, 70s and maybe into the 80s towards a sort of neoliberalising political philosophy. So we've got a neoliberalising of education policy in the OECD countries. Anyway, Barzi argues there's sort of two models of the germ. There's one that's still well and truly ensconced in the social democratic logic in the Scandinavian countries. And the one that Australia, the UK and the US have adopted is sort of a neoliberalising marketising model. So we've gone over to sort of full-on marketising logic.
Yeah. And in particular, your first logic is the marketised version of school devolution. So schools are set up to compete with each other in the market, even if they're in a public system. But, public, private, Catholic, whatever. they're all set up to compete with each other in the one market, and all responsibility is devolved back to the school so that there's government and agencies like that aren't responsible for anything. It's all up at the school, down at the school level.
I mean, before we sort of, you know, quickly disentangle the four logics that I've been discerning over, you know, 40 years of studying schooling, I think that my sort of basic proposition, though, is arguing that Australian schooling is suffering from a sort of poly crisis. There's a sort of an interacting set of troubles, and we could say the troubles would be falling student achievement, an intensifying teacher shortage, a crisis of leadership, i.e. too few people want to put their hand up to be the principal of schools these days, and we've got increasing numbers of students not attending, they're disengaged and not completing schooling. And across all of that, Australia is one of the most unequal schooling systems in the OECD.
Yes.
But then when we listen to, you know, what is government saying about instead of troubles, all we hear from them is blaming schools, teachers and school leaders, and there's almost nothing said by those governing about the failure of their own policy logic.
Yeah, you said last year that the policy regime is failing spectacularly, yet it seems to be Teflon-coated, defended by all these different agencies and actors, and that the governments in Australia have all seemed to be swayed by their arguments.
I mean, one of the things that I've spent a few years, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, trying to sort of, you know, map out the failure of policy logics, which we'll get onto in a minute. But then a couple of years ago, I started to think that the real question we should be pondering is, what's sustaining failed policy regime? And all I can come up with is, you know, snouts in the trough. So there's a lot of snouts in the trough that are ensuring that Australian governments maintain a policy that's completely failing.
Yep, exactly. And I think we'll go into that a little bit later, that, you know, the follow-up for that bit. But I think the idea that we've got this poly crisis and that there are a number of different instruments that we use, or logics in your terms, a number of different logics that support that. And the first of those is the marketised version.
Yeah, I mean, there's the whole. One of the things that I find real extraordinary is the key policy logics that teachers and students and so on are working within, completely absent from the conversation.
Yeah.
all we really hear about is the school funding problems and why aren't teachers implementing the learning science?
That's right.
That's basically where we get to. But let's just pick, you know. You wanted to start off with devolution. I've spent my career in South Australia, and I started teaching in the late 1970s. But historically, in the early 1970s, the South Australian Education Department devolved responsibility to schools for making curriculum decisions.
Yeah.
So this was the sort of early progressive version of school devolution. So all of a sudden, right around the country, we're starting to devolve decision-making for important things that are going on inside of classrooms in the schools, and we've had probably 3 decades of experiments with that, and most of those experiments were in some amount of success.
Yep.
And then we moved to a sort of neo-liberalising of policy, so not surprisingly, the very idea of devolution got marketised, so all of a sudden we abandoned devolving responsibility for curriculum decision-making being the key logic for devolution to, okay, we're all operating in a quasi-market. You now compete for students, and a sort of a market-driven logic is going to be the driver for school innovation.
Yeah.
We know where that's got us.
Yes.
It's got us into being one of the least equal schooling systems in the OECD, and no one wants to talk about the problem with devolution.
Mm.
I mean, one of the other things that's interesting, of course, is that the four logics that I identify, when you go digging around, about whether or not those logics have actually improved student learning. And what we find is that none of the logics stack up. So the sort of marketized version of devolution, the sort of grandfather of that logic's Brian Caldwell.
Yep.
When you go reading Brian Caldwell's more recent work, he even admits himself that he hasn't been able to find the evidence that it improves student learning.
That's
sorry for laughing.
No, it's that kind of macabre laughing of we've put all this huge investment into accountability and governance and managerialism at the school level, so principals can really get a minute to do anything that's actually educational leadership for the poor, for the school, and I think that goes hand in hand with what you called your second logic, the logic of standardisation.
I think that's one of the things that you would anticipate with the logic of devolution is that a thousand flowers bloom.
Yes.
But what's happened under a marketized version of devolution is that there's only one type of flower.
That's right. Everyone has to do the same thing. And that also feeds into the centre's desire to measure everything. And if everything has to be done the same way, it's easier for people to measure. Because they're measuring the same thing, but the curriculum therefore has followed that you're going to have a standardised curriculum, syllabuses, that instead of having education that's tailored to actual classes and the actual students you have in front of you, whether you're in a remote rural school or an Aboriginal school or a school full of 52 different languages and cultures, or you're in an upper class school somewhere else.
Well, I think the standardisation process has clearly been driven in some part by the sort of national curriculum and the way that that gets sort of implemented or enacted. But also, since the 1990s, education systems have codified good teaching, codified the good leader. Mandated the national curriculum, and through the codification, of course, you just get this sort of narrowing of what's on, and people's sort of ability to be promoted is sort of evaluated by how they stack up against a codified standard that, by its own admission, is sort of. It's impossible to codify a good teacher or a good leader, but the systems have a go at it for their fetishisation of accountability.
Yeah.
When I was working with John Smyth, the federal government decided to trial a competency framework for beginning teachers.
Yep.
And we did our trialling out in the northern suburbs. And what the teachers that we worked with sort of told us when they got to review the framework was that it assumed that teachers are individuals working on their own in classrooms, and inherently it represented a sort of middle class reality. So all of these codifications of teaching and leading is all shot through with very very unhelpful sort of renditions of what it means to be a good teacher or a good leader.
That's right. And into that, into that codification, which has now become the professional standards nationally, we then introduced high-stakes testing and performative accountability.
Exactly.
Can you say more about that?
That was sort of, I've argued that that's my sort of third logic. So
yeah.
The first two, you've got marketised devolution, standardisation, standardisation really being one size fits all.
Yep.
One of the things that goes on with this set of logics is the knowledge that is asserted to be the evidence is usually decontextualised. So
yes.
there's universalising truth claims which completely ignore context. And I don't know about you, Murray, but I always thought that good social science can only claim truth if it's radically contextualised. So we've now got an Australian schooling system that asserts a regime of truth that's a decontextualized nonsense. So, you know, truth claims that pay no attention to context aren't really of this world.
No, that's not good social science.
They should be put in the bin.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, we've got the sort of NAPLAN. So, again, you know, we've adopted the NAPLAN from, you know, high stakes testing from, you know, the failed experiments in the US.
Yes.
Again, when you go looking at the evidence for improving student learning, it's quite clear in all the sort of major jurisdictions that have done it that it doesn't improve student learning. Unfortunately, of course, the, you know, governments are now so committed to the NAPLAN they can't sort of see their way into thinking how they might be done with it. Even though New Zealand got rid of their high stakes testing a few years ago, so yeah. You know, the world didn't collapse.
That's right, and it is interesting that here we are, you know, that this quite expensive section of the national and state economies is health and education, and yet we're spending a fortune on major infrastructure such as NAPLAN.
I mean, the thing that's ironically funny in the last few months. The Murdoch press continue to do their sort of league tables, and the head of IFSL and so forth is now offended by the misuse of the NAPLAN results, feeding into an unhelpful marketising logic.
Yes.
Here we are. How much longer are we going to put up with this nonsense?
Yes, I mean, I think that the key problem for me that emerges from a whole range of that is the interventions of the federal government and the ways in which state governments, which are constitutionally responsible for education and schooling in particular, have given over through their meeting of the ministers, they've given over their infrastructure. You know, they don't have to spend money on having a big research branch or a big curriculum branch or all of those things, because there are all these little national quangos that have been set up, and they've all been, at the moment they're in the process of all amalgamating all these organisations into one. But I think it might make it easier for us to argue to keep the federal government out of the intervention into education. Because, as you say, there's very little evidence that any of these three logics, you know, the marketised version, the standardisation or the high-stakes testing, improve anything about student learning, and that's, even if one is quite sceptical of them, that's actually shown up in our fairly static position and going backwards in international terms testing.
Well, yeah. it certainly feeds into the sort of, you know, our unfortunate claim to be one of the least equal systems in the OECD. And I'm sorry, but that polycrisis that I'm mentioning is really driven by the intensifying of educational inequality in the country. And until we actually seriously try to undermine the sort of processes of inequality in the country, then the polycrisis is just going to get worse.
Yeah. And I think that what that's interesting is you see the contradictions even among these three logics that you've mentioned, and yet your fourth logic becomes the new gold standard, which is to let's adopt the truth claims of all these narrow forms of research and just go hell for leather and invest in them.
Well, your fourth logic's the one that's most complicated, probably, but the way that I'm naming it up, it's historically, if you go back 10 years, many of us were really, really worried about the sort of the increasing influence of what used to be called school effectiveness and school improvement, which was a sort of a paradigm for school reform, which was really been entrenched by the OECD. So back to our early comment, the global education reform movement, you know, 20 years ago, just really got behind the sort of school effectiveness movement.
Yeah.
Now, in the last 10 years, the school effectiveness movement sort of given birth to what's called the science of teaching or the what works learning science. So all of a sudden you've got these, I'm calling them knowledge grifters.
Yes.
Sort of appear in the scene claiming that they've got access to educational science.
Yep.
That's their first sentence. I'm a scientist. And then they proposed that they've got or assume they've got privileged access to truth.
Yep.
In which case, no one can criticise them. All of their truth claims are beyond criticism, actually. And but when you go looking at what their truth claims are, it's all junk science or scientism at best.
Yes, and just reminding people, you're listening to Think Again, 3CR 855 on your dial, 3CR digital and streaming live at 3cr.org.au. I'm here with Rob Haddam from Adelaide University discussing the problematic way that the current logics underpinning the current policy regime in education actually undermine what's possible to do in schools and in teacher education. And Rob's just been mentioning this term, knowledge grifter, which I think's absolutely wonderful term. Can you say about a little bit more about what's meant by that?
I don't know. The concept of the grifters become sort of interesting politically in the last, you know, half a dozen years because of the way that the American political scene's going. So I think The Atlantic published a piece in 2019, the grifter in the White House. And, you know, the concept of the grifter is a sort of an American southern states concept where, you know, some shady character comes to town and tries to sell you a scam and make money out of you, basically. That's
a petty swindler.
Yeah, that's right, a petty swindler. So I'm sort of pushing the argument a little bit to be a little bit controversial, but one of the things that really, really, you know, that I've tried to do in my own writing in the last couple of years is to try to make a defence for good social science.
Yes.
And what I see, the so-called, what works learning science people or the science of teaching mob is it just doesn't stack up as good social science. So maybe as an example, it's a tried example, but one that will become more significant in the next few months. On the front cover of John Hattie's book, Visible Learning, he claims to have found the holy grail of teaching. I'm sorry, that's not science.
No.
To claim that you've got the answer once and for all is not scientific.
Yes.
That is completely antithetical to a scientific sensibility. So, and then when you go and have a look at what he's done, he's sort of statistically manipulated all these studies and compared oranges to apples and all sorts of stuff, and we could spend a whole session on the sort of downside of John Hattie's methodology and the sort of truth claims that he makes, but he's sort of... unfortunately, the whole edifice of the learning science movement has now been sort of advanced by the Australian Educational Research Organisation.
Yes.
Who claims to be the mediator of reliable evidence for policy in the country.
Yes.
And they've come up with a sort of hierarchy of evidence, and the most reliable evidence, according to them, is meta-analyses of randomised classroom trials, which, of course, is John Hattie's work. And unfortunately, it does appear as though Eero and the other sycophants have failed to actually read the critiques of meta-analyses of randomised classroom trials, and as a consequence, of course, what we now find is that Eero and the other knowledge grifters has fetishised a very narrow version of cognitive psychology as being the only place where one can find truth in concert with brain science, and they've ignored anthropology, history, philosophy. The thing that's really, really offensive about what's going on is that they've ignored 40 years of curriculum studies.
Yes.
So we've now got truth claims being made about schooling that are completely ignoring educational knowledge that's been generated across the globe for 40 or 50 years.
Ah, well, those are some pretty impressive logics there that you've identified and analysed some of the key problems that research in this, that other forms of research than the randomised controlled trials, but also some randomised controlled trials have actually disproved a number of the claims and or have actually made problematic the focus of what these trials are doing, and therefore we need to be able to think about what we might need to replace these logics, you know, when instead of just blaming schools for not being able to fight off the policy logics or blaming teachers for not complying with these logics, we might want to start thinking more, and I know you've done quite a lot of work on this, but as we're coming towards the end of this particular session, we want to offer, I think, in future interviews, we might want to offer some positive and constructive options for replacing the practices that go along with these policy logics. And you've given us some really helpful language and terminology, you know, to understand what's going on in that broader false promises of the current regime. But you're also giving us, by implication, some new directions for how we might understand the work of teachers and develop some new purposes for schooling. And so I'll be talking about with you again and with some other colleagues and academics and policy workers around the place in future exhibits. Okay, so just making a bit of a community announcement. Borderlands has a major two-year project that's been funded by the Foundation for Greater Melbourne, which is to build a people's plan for Footscray. And a diverse group came together two weekends ago to start mapping out how we might ensure active participation from a wide range of communities in Footscray. And if we do it well, we're hoping that the process we develop can be used by other local governments and organisations in the western suburbs of Melbourne to promote participatory and democratic planning. So thank you, listeners, for tuning in to Think Again live on 3CR Community Radio today. If you want to contact us or give us feedback, you can email Borderlands. The email address is borders@borderlands.org.au. Our programs are available by podcasts on a variety of platforms and on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au. Meanwhile, please enjoy Milk Humana by King Stingray.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.